Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webno.com. Today we continue our ongoing discussion on online education, online distance learning, remote learning, the trend that has overtaken most U.S. American public education, with John Plisak. He will be our special guest, so thank you for joining us. John Plisak has an MA in English and has taught college rhetoric and research argumentation for over 8 years. His literary scholarship concentrates on the history of global eugenics and Aldous Huxley's dystopic novel, Brave New World. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education, and he is a contributor to the Center for Research on Globalization, Op-Ed News, The Intrepid Report, The Dissident Voice, The Activist Post, and Counter Markets. Plisak is also the director of writing and editing at Black Freighter Productions Books. He holds a black belt in classical taekwondo and is a certified kickboxing instructor under the International Muay Thai Boxing Association. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Let's start with Andy. Just share with us, Andy, your connection to John so that we could get a framework from where how this connection get started.
Yeah. Well, as in our previous episodes, we've been going deeper and deeper into this rabbit hole of distance learning and data collection and data mining and technology. And we had Allison McDowell on our show, and she's somebody who really started me going down this rabbit hole. And I was on her Facebook page, and I saw somebody mention this person, John Plisak, and with a YouTube video. And I can't find that YouTube video. I saw you interviewed on John, but everything he was talking about was all that she had mentioned, but so much really focused on the what's happening in education. And this really is concerning me because it's coming in August, the 100% distance learning. That's the plan in California for most of the districts. And they're saying it's about keeping us safe and stuff like that. And I just felt like really is the time to hear what. And then I saw this book that I've ordered. I haven't got it yet, the School World Order that he had done recently. And it was like it was all it seemed like to be a prediction of what was happening well before COVID had come. And that was very meaningful to me because I need to get up to speed on this. And I wanted to see if we could interview him and see what we could learn. So I was really grateful that he was willing to do this. And I just want to see where it takes us today.
Well, thanks a bunch for having me. And, you know, we talked on the phone before. And like I told you, I'm really happy to be here with other teachers talking about this. So I've done several shows, but not with any teachers yet. So this is big for me. Yeah. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Oh, I should mention, I cited Allison McDowell in my book. But I did actually, I mixed it up with one of her colleagues, Morna McNulty, and she was super gracious when I told her I misattributed. They were both super gracious. But so her work is cited in there. It's just under Morna McNulty. And the next printing, as I told her, we will correct that. But that was one issue there. But yeah, she's great. She's very great. Yeah.
No, she's awesome. Well, yeah, why don't we start with the basics, then, I guess, John, why don't you share with us who you are and how did you get into this? It's mostly around your background for yourself, all of this. How did you enter into this?
So my research really starts with a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America by a woman who worked in the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan during his private sector initiative. Her name is Charlotte Thompson Iserby, and she blew the whistle on something called Project BEST, Better Education Skills Through Technology, which was facilitated under the private sector initiative at the time. I remember hearing some interviews with her where she talked about school choice being this buzzword or this code word for merging the corporate and the government sectors together, so merging basically through what they call public-private partnerships, at the education level, and that would also merge your education with other departments, so like health and human services and criminal justice and things like that. And several years ago, when Bruce Rauner was still the governor of Illinois, he was stalling on the budget, and basically what happened was we couldn't get public funds, and one of my departments had to get shut down because of it. And if you know anything about Bruce Rauner, he was a big proponent of school choice, and his State of the Union addresses, he always talked about all the buzzwords that Charlotte mentioned. So school choice, cradle to career, big on the, there was the, you saw floating around in the rhetoric, the P20 councils, which is another public-private partnership. And then there was the element, oh, I should mention that Bruce Rauner also is heavily invested in charter schools, and there's a Rauner College Prep somewhere in Chicago as well, okay? So, you know, he also had, you know, some personal interest in that, and I saw it as a ploy to privatize, because, you know, when a department goes bankrupt, especially if it's something like what they call the adult education departments, which are usually heavily funded by federal and state funds, they can go into private receivership, okay, through grants and other things like that. And so I saw this as a move to do that, and I saw all the things that Charlotte talked about happening. And then at the time, I was also working with some of the virtual platforms. And I noticed that something else that she talked about, which was the Project Best angle, that was basically being facilitated through these adaptive learning softwares and other data mining softwares. They're basically built on B.F. Skinner's programmed instruction, his teaching machine, which was based on his Skinner box, which is basically operant conditioning. So changing education from the art of learning to the science of conditioning. And so I saw all that stuff coming together, and I decided to start writing some stuff. I wrote an article that just kind of pointed out how, you know, right Rauner was kind of pushing this agenda. She reached out, said I was spot on, and then ended up, you know, just helping me with a lot of the research. She wrote the foreword to my book, helped connect me with my publisher, Chris Milligan. And so she's been amazing, and it just a bit from there just turned into a book, and here we are today. So that's the background for how I got into this.
Yeah, and I know we're gonna talk more about what's going on with distance learning. But if you wouldn't mind, can you say more about this Skinner box thing? Because I know it's a framework that you have for almost your, and my familiarity with the BF Skinner box is like a little mouse or a dog, Pavlov's. You know, a dog with a bell or things like that. Is that, well, can you just say more about it in terms of what that work is and how that frames what education's going to become more like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so you're right. It's based on animal conditioning is where they basically build the principles. Okay. Operant conditioning is just a more fancy or complicated version of what Wilhelm Wundt came up with, which was stimulus response conditioning. That became classical conditioning. That's Pavlov's dog stuff. Then later they would add reward and punishment series. They would call it behaviorism. And then Skinner added these four quadrants, you know, so positive and negative punishment, positive and negative reward. Okay. And then he just made the scheduling a little more sophisticated. But the idea is that, you can condition the mind by conditioning the behavior through the nervous system in reaction to stimuli or response to stimuli, okay? So the classical example with Pavlov's dog is, right, you have a natural stimulus, which is food. You have a natural response, which is salivation. You can associate something with the natural stimulus, an artificial stimulus like a bell, and then you can condition the dog to have a response to the bell stimulus, okay? So take that principle and then turn the stimulus into learning stimuli. So basically problems, exercises, questions, maybe short answer, multiple choice, matching, etc. And put it on a reel of tape, and the student's answer is there, then the response. And based on the stimulus response algorithms, you could personalize a student's trajectory into either academic training or workforce training, okay, based on these personalized data mining algorithms of the cognitive behavioral stimulus response. To give you a picture of what it looked like, B.F. Skinner actually made it. You can go on the Smithsonian's website and you can see pictures of them. If you've ever seen, if y'all remember the Viewmasters, remember the Viewmasters?
Yeah.
And so it had these little things, like these goggles, and then it had like Disney little cartoons in this wheel, and you could see a picture in there, and then you click this button, and then it turns the wheel, and you see a new picture. So take that same idea, except questions and answers on a reel of tape. It only goes one way. Based on your answer, it would either remediate you for workforce training, or it might accelerate you to maybe like gifted education or something. And he even had some that were designed to dispense chocolate if you got a correct answer. So there's the actual reward mechanism. Now, MOVE today, and that is the modern adaptive learning software. It's the same principle. You just change the gears and the wheels and the roll of tape, turn it into virtual windows and clicks on a mouse. And then, you know, the algorithms perhaps are a little more precise because they have more categories to data mine, more responses to more precise stimuli perhaps. It can be more interactive because they might have some virtual media, so like videos or, you know, audio or some other game you can play that's, you know, a little more interactive. But the principle is the same, right? You're getting learning stimuli through a virtual screen based on your clicks or your responses. It's going to data mine how fast you do it, how effectively you do it, and then it's going to put you in a career pathway. And maybe if you're lucky, it might put you in, like, a gifted route. Okay, but that's kind of how Skinner's technology translates into modern adaptive learning software. And I should say there's, you know, so we might talk about social-emotional learning software as well. Some of those probably more further down the pipe, but they use them in China already. Those are data mining your basically your emotions through EEG or the Gates Foundation had something called galvanic skin response monitors. Could be heart rate, okay, maybe facial recognition algorithm. But the same idea is it's still based on your not just your cognitive, the adaptive learning is looking at your cognitive responses to the stimuli. These other things are going to data mine your emotional or your nervous system level to the stimuli. And based on an aggregate of those two things, they'll funnel that into your career pathways, or your hopefully your academic pathways.
John, can you maybe talk about the implications of this, and you know what would you say to someone that argues wouldn't these expand the possibilities of human potential?
Yeah. So one of the principles. So the idea here is that, right, they pitch it as personalized education or individualized education. But the personalization, if you really look at it, has to do with the company or the software or the algorithm is personalizing its ability to shape you for whatever are the career pathways or academic pathways that have already been carved out. You know, there's no, once this thing data mines you and says your aptitude is for X, Y, or Z, you can't say, I think the algorithm's wrong. I want to try, you know, another route. And then there's another element that is, there's a gamification aspect to some of it. So as I mentioned, built into these is like sometimes video games or things that are supposed to make it funner or more interactive. And the idea is that the easier you make stuff, or the funner you make stuff, the easier you make it. And the easier you make it, the more effective the outcome becomes. But I don't think that's actually personalizing anything either, because if you ever really get super involved in something, like, you know, I loved writing the book, I loved reading for it, but there's plenty of times when I was tired at night and wanted to go to bed. And so there's the other element that stimulus response method basically conditions students to think that learning happens when I respond to some stimuli that's all pre-provided through a screen or some other authority. And so it takes away motivation, and pedagogically it's personalizing for the companies, not for the student, would be my rebuttal to that.
So it's sort of like what's being personalized is the information for the larger system to then direct you in a more personalized way to one avenue versus another. It's not actually saying, oh, we're providing you all these opportunities. you decide how you move down the Pachinko board. It's like we're going to decide how you move through it.
Yeah, and it's built on literally the same algorithms they use for personalized advertising, right? We know that's not exactly to make you empowered necessarily. It's to sell more stuff to you, right? And literally, I might get the precise citation. So my article is Billionaire Betsy DeVos, Big Data in the Public-Private Planned Economy. And I'm pretty sure it's Dreambox is the specific adaptive learning software, and it uses an adaptive learning algorithm that I think is used by either Amazon or Netflix. Just check the article for the specifics. But and it was the personalized behavioral advertising algorithms designed to, you know, feed you what videos you like. So it comes from a commercial mindset and agenda. And you know, that's another way that those career pathways plug into that too.
So John, in about a few weeks, a bunch of us teachers across the country and definitely in California are going to start largely this 100% distance learning. All right. And it's already been reported that did not work, like as an educational experience, it did not work. And as a teaching experience, and I think you're a teacher as well. You know, we're going to be doing this thing of Google chats or Zoom classes, and teachers aren't going to like it. Students aren't going to like it. But we're going to say, oh, we're going to have to do this. What is it that educators don't know? Like, we don't like this experience, but we felt like we have to do it. What is it that you think teachers need to know what that's really behind all this distance learning that is more than just this sucks, it's very impersonal, it's really alienating, it's actually slow, it doesn't really seem to be a great way of interacting with students or interacting with each other. But I think there's a lot of things you know that we as teachers don't know about what's all behind this 100% distance learning thing we're headed towards. So maybe you could say more about that.
Okay. Yeah, maybe let's talk about some of the long-term structural institutional changes that are in the pipe and happening right now. And so we can talk about some of the new regulations, some of the competition, some of the foundations involved in facilitating all of this. But I'd like to preface that, as you mentioned, you know, that students or teachers might not be aware of a lot of what's happening, but you have the sense that, right, something's not right. I would say that at the very least, right, nurture that feeling of what's happening and nurture the move towards trying to actually know, because we're making up not just education. Across the economy, across the government, we're making sweeping changes into uncharted waters. And at the very least, we need to be asking questions about where we're going and maybe, you know, asking people to pump the brakes on some, because some of these changes are intended to be permanent. And if you don't think that that's what's going to happen, this is, you know, just look at some of the changes after the Patriot Act. Right, that stuff was only supposed to be for, you know, during the war on terror, which I guess we're still in, right? And so that's we have them still today, right? And so same idea, right? Once you abdicate, you know, authority to big business or big government, especially when they're on the same page together, it's easier to hold them off from getting their foot than it is to take it back. So some of the bills to be aware of, or some of the structural changes to be aware of. The first one I would say is the new federal regulations for distance learning and innovation. So that's 85 FR 18638. And you know, this by the way, and you don't have to just read these entire bills, because that's actually not how you do it. And use your keyword search, use your control F search, okay? And actually, I gave you a list of keywords. Maybe we can post that somewhere or something. And those, if you can pretty much get a, you know, there'll be a learning curve, you know, understand what do these terms mean. Once you grasp the general grammar, you can keyword search this stuff, and you can get to the crux of the bills pretty quickly, okay? And so if you do a keyword search in that bill for competency-based education, and also adaptive learning. They specifically refer to adaptive learning, and they refer to it as artificial intelligence. So you can do a keyword search for all three of those. Basically, what it does is it deregulates the requirements for teaching online. So you probably recall that before this, we all had to have certifications to teach online. Like you, I never got it. I like to teach in person. So for people like me, what they did when COVID happened, they locked everybody down, sent everybody home. They said, in order for those to legally be accredited, those classes that I was going to teach and other people were going to teach, they had to go to your state board, your accreditation board, and then sort of get some loopholes. And then, well, at the federal level, they did the same thing. And that's what this bill, these regulations are that I'm referring to. And in there, what it says is, and I'm paraphrasing, but it just uses the specific language that they're going to authorize instruction that is, quote, without, this part is, quote, without a human teacher. Okay, and that means at least in part, okay, so you'll have, there'll be a transitional period where you're largely, we're facilitating these modules, but a lot of that feedback is going to be delivered, what they call through direct instruction, that you can also keyword search in there, but it's through the algorithms, it's through the personalized adaptive learning. And, as you mentioned, there's many pedagogical problems with this process, but one is that they are emphasizing in a lot of schools, and some of the schools where I teach, the asynchronous approach. So there's no synchronous virtual meetings. So the theory there is that if you let students pace themselves, this is competency-based education is a key principle of it. If you let students pace themselves, they'll be able to manage their time better. Well, what I found is that I have a lot more students who also are saying, oh, it's not all due until the end, and putting a bunch of it off. And, as we think we talked about before the show, when you're working at home, things are distracting. And so even if you want to do some work to, the dog or the kids or, whatever's happening, so you don't have ideal, it's a lot harder to prioritize and organize. And then that's on both ends for the teacher as well. So what if the student's a night owl and they're typically emailing me when I'm asleep? And they're wanting their feedback, but they're waiting. And then they're asleep during the day when I'm up. And now, so this is going to incentivize the automated feedback through the adaptive learning. And that's why competency-based education is referred to over 100 times in those little regulations. If you look at the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, which is the overarching federal bill that regulates basically all of federal education, the competency-based education is in there, as you kind of maybe on two hands, maybe twice on two hands. And so it's very much about automated feedback on a competency-based structure. And what that also means is that they want to go away from the credit system to a subscription basis. So instead of having to complete a certain number of course credits over, whatever is the semester period, different schools have different blocks, you'll just have to demonstrate competency at a certain number of modules at your own pace. And as long as you pay your monthly subscription, you can keep re-enrolling and, do the same module for a year. Or, look at the other side, they would say you can finish the class a lot faster. And then there are students that do work ahead. I do see that. But so the idea there then is to get away from that, because then the classes have to be facilitated by online virtual education companies, software companies, because you can't do that in a building, right? The student with, you've got 30 seats in a classroom, half the students can't hang out there for 3 years, but you can in a module, right? And you can still roll over new student body every year. So that's the... those are the federal regulations to be aware of, and then to be aware of your school or your department looking to get CARES money for that stuff. So the reason why they deregulated this stuff is so they could also put more money into these companies. And this is where not just the CARES Act itself comes in and all the money that's designated for virtual learning, but there's DeVos released CARES competitions. One is Rethink K-12 Education, and that's all about technology infrastructure. And then the other one is Reimagine Workforce Preparation. So that's to funnel those virtual courseware into you know, the career pathways curriculum. So, you know, be looking for those buzzwords to pop up in your school, and, you know, maybe at least ask questions or push back. And we might talk more about what are some of the questions you might want to ask about and stuff. But those would be the laws, the bills to be aware of, you know, do those keyword searches on them.
I have a quick question, because I have my experience mostly has been in primary education, and I'm just curious if this adaptive learning will also be pushed onto younger students that I just find would be challenging to do with, let's say, first graders. I mean, is this even, do you know if that's being pushed onto primary education as well?
You know, I'm always inadvertently focused, you know, because from looking first from the college level, because that's where I'm at. I did do second year enter. So I don't want to say that I know exactly what they do at the end. And if you're saying it sounds like maybe it wouldn't fit, but if my memory is correct, I don't know if they were first grade. They were certainly lower middle school, if not elementary ed level students. And there was an IBM partnership. So IBM's got its Watson. It's an artificial intelligence thing, and it can do, it does stuff for security, finance, healthcare, taxes, but it does stuff for education too. And it does some of this automated feedback. And they were doing a partnership with Sesame Street to create some kind of gamified platform where you would interact, the kids would interact with the Sesame Street characters. So at some level, there is a gamification aspect to that. And, there is also an industry of gamifying, turning toys into gamified learning. So instead of like modules on a screen with reading and calculation, you know, maybe little interactive play sets that have the same sort of competencies, algorithms built into, you know.
Yeah.
But definitely, yeah, in the book, there was some Sesame Street sort of stuff. So I'm guessing, right, that's got to be around that eight or so.
Well, I guess it would be safe to assume that they're going to be pushed on even just to primary education, because, I mean, there is a lot of corporate interest there as well. And Alison McDowell as well, she was also expanding a little bit about programs that are being used to sort of train kids, as you had said, with sort of software, with reward systems or sort of carrot stick programs that would make children be very conformed in their classrooms. Go ahead, Andy.
I was talking to AJ, a fellow teacher, and she is saying that the plan in San Francisco is actually, I mean, they're going to be doing some distance learning, but a lot of what they're going to be asking of those students is to go to like SF MoMA to do community enrichment experiences, that they're actually not going to be going to schools. They're going to be going to these different community services that are not schools. It's part of the, as I see it, part of the dismantling process of physical public education is to offshore it. It's outsourcing it to these other institutions. I don't know if you have familiarity with that process, if that's anywhere that, but that's, it seems to be a little different. Like middle school and high school is going to be like distance learning. Your teacher will become AI, but elementary school, it looks like they're like disbanding the schools and outsourcing it to these other community engagement places.
Yeah, this is something that I didn't talk a lot about in the book, but am digging into more now. Our friend who we talked about, this is a project that her and I are going to write about. I'm not sure that we want to talk too much about it yet as far as what we're going to write. But the idea is, so I talked about school choice and the privatization movement. And that usually means charter schools, vouchers, tax credits for tuition savings, and then the education savings accounts. Okay, and this is a way to funnel public dollars into these corporate schools, these privately owned, either for-profit or nonprofit schools. There's a big move right now where people think that community schools are the answer to charter schools. And I wrote an article called "Community Tutors Are Not the Antidote to Charter Schools." Because if you look at what is a full-service community school, it's public-private partnerships, and it's just like you said, it's merging. So when your students go and they do these little, I guess, performance based, active learning, modules, they're actually in the physical space, but these activities, these exercises to earn their competency score, when they do that, they're going to be working, they're basically going to be doing free labor for companies, you know, and this is the same thing for the career pathways. Like, you know, what you're paying for is not just, you know, to train the students to get a good job. You're paying for the training that would otherwise have been paid for by the company that they got hired at. And so, you know, don't be fooled by the communitarian rhetoric, because you have to, again, you can do Google or keyword searches in the bills in ESSA. Okay, look at community schools in the ESSA bill and just look at it, what it says, public-private partnerships. It's, you know, it has to have a certain number of them. And they have to also facilitate mental health, and then there has to be like a criminal justice component in there. Okay, so maybe I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole way up front, but when you aggregate all the data, the students' thinking data, cognitive behavior, the students' feeling data, socio-emotional learning, and they take that data and they start sharing it, you know, they take it and take it from FERPA, where it should be kept safe, and they start sharing it with HIPAA and then, you know, police departments, you know, for an at-risk student and things, right? This data is going to follow them for the rest of their lives and be used to facilitate, you know, workforce planning, social engineering, and, you know, pre-crime, basically. You know, it sounds goofy, but I mean, pretty much, if you look at, they have things like red flag laws. I mean, what is that? That's saying that somebody might do something before they actually did it. I mean, so just take that principle, take those algorithms, transfer it to some student that doesn't behave very well or that this teacher doesn't like. Now, the teachers, you're going to be tracked too. And they're going to look at both of those algorithms, and this is how it's going to be, this is going to be pitched as objective, all right? And they're going to pitch this as, right now, there's this, you know, we have the George Floyd stuff and the real racial problems in the country. They're going to pitch data as this objective thing that's going to say, no, now racism's gone because your subjective positions were quantified and we figured out who was right and the wrong and the right. And this is where the move forward is in schooling and in policing, by the way, so.
So you mentioned that we've talked about this in previous shows, that there is a massive restructuring of society, you know, happening, you know, the way we interact with each other, the way we learn, the way we work. And to some people, it may seem like a sudden thing, but you mentioned in one of your articles from the Intrepid Report, you know, you start with Reagan in that period in. So my curiosity is more about, is there a linear progress to this moment? You know, and some people draw differences between Republicans and Democrats or liberal versus conservative institutions. Like, what do you have to say to this?
Okay, so let's start with Project BEST, which is, that's Reagan. Reagan's private sector initiative, better education skills through technology, okay? It was set up by Secretary of Education T.H. Bell, but then a year later it was handed off to Secretary of Education Bill Bennett. Bill Bennett set up K-12 Inc., which is one of the biggest online companies there are now. If you're one of the few people that still has a TV and you watch regular TV, they have commercials for K-12 Inc. all the time, okay? So that's one of the companies that's getting a big boon from the CARES Act and all this stuff we're talking about now. Now, K-12 Inc. is also funded by Secretary DeVos right now, okay? Peter Thiel, who funds adaptive learning software, including Clever and Newton, two different companies, he was Bill Bennett's speechwriter. Now, I got a FOIA request that shows that when Secretary DeVos was on her early education tour, she met privately with. We don't know what they talked about because they met privately. You just saw on her itinerary that she went to his house. Now, what did they probably talk about? Well, probably the same thing that he talked about with Bill Bennett, which seems to be pushing, right, virtual online companies that facilitate Skinner Box adaptive learning software. In other words, phase two of Project BEST. Now, I just named two Republican institutions. And then there's another one in the middle, Bush, right? But then in between those two, you got Clinton and Obama, okay? So Project Best basically sets up the idea of the public-private partnership. It's Clinton, though, that... I skipped over Bush, but I'm going to jump straight to Clinton. Look at the left. Bush the older. I skipped over it. Clinton sets up charter schools. You see, there's the first official charter school, the federal charter school bill is signed off by Bill Clinton. Okay, so that's left. Okay, then you got Bush the younger comes in. Right? No Child Left Behind. Charter schools get a big boon. Okay. Obama comes in. Who does he pick for secretary? He's on the left, right? Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. CPS Chicago, right? Probably one of the biggest privatizers of education except for Paul Vallis, okay? What did he do? He did the same thing that he did when Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gave him money to CPS. He just ran through a bunch of charter schools. And now you got Trump in with Betsy DeVos, and they're all about school choice as well, okay? And don't think that they're not for community schools either, because those are just different rhetorical labels for the same process, okay? So there is a direct line. It's the same agenda through all the blue-red, blue-red. It's just, left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot.
A big purple wave.
I should mention, and since I mentioned Gates, but no, I should also mention this. Rauner, it's in my first chapter.
You just made me remember when they came out with the purple after the election with the purple tie or the purple shirt. But
Rauner basically buddies with Duncan, Arne Duncan. Okay, and basically, let's just say it like this: it was so long ago. One of them got their daughter into the charter school with help from the other. Let's put it that way. Okay, I can't remember how they exchanged with. But they're literally working again. And his whole agenda was to change, with the Democrats, with the left did. But Arne Duncan got a lot of money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I've got over 66 grants. I thought it was 66, but I miscounted. It's actually more. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation grants in my book. It includes everything from school choice, cradle to career, public-private partnerships, data aggregation, P20 councils, adaptive learning software, artificial intelligence, and the big thing that they're ramming through right now is something called reimagining education. It's called the same thing that the CARES Act competition is called, which is reimagined workforce preparation. And guess what? It's the same thing that they're calling reimagined policing. You think they all got something in common? Yes, it's big data. It got some bad media coverage when he announced that, Governor Cuomo in New York announced that he was going to partner with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Eric Schmidt of Alphabet Inc., which is Google's parent company. So media kind of said shh after that. And so I dug into the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation grants. I looked at all of them that had anything to do with education from basically since COVID started all the way through June. And about 200-something grants, over $250 million in education. Some of it, I will say, was not for pedagogy, methodology, technology. Some of it was for contact tracing or funding universities to do studies about COVID, but still money in the education system. And it obviously, fuels the narrative that we need the distance learning and it all works together. But one of the key things that I saw that looked like a window into the Reimagine Education Partnership in New York has to do with a partnership between this New York nonprofit called Innovate EDU and a big database from Google called BigQuery. And they have this connector. This app that connects your Google Classroom data to BigQuery. Now, BigQuery is like a big data analytics. It's similar to, if y'all remember, in Bloom that got a big heat back in the day, and then something similar called Learnster. So in Bloom was set up, it was this cloud that they wanted to aggregate all the student data in so that ed tech companies and learning engineers and other administrators could go in and do this metadata analysis. And it was operating. It got shut down because people were like, where are you putting that? You're putting it in a cloud? It's Amazon Cloud, where the CIA also stores its data, and then it was managed on a server by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. So, something like that. So he came with LearnSphere, which is a distributed infrastructure. Instead of it being like on one cloud, it's basically, you know, I guess, different databases that you have to request and that are shared. You don't just grab it and just pull it all out. You know, you have to network through it. So that's supposed to make it safer. But the BigQuery also links to something called Cortex, which is linked into LearnSphere. So all these, there's numerous databases like this, but the BigQuery, and by the way, BigQuery can be used to do big analytics of other stuff, other companies can put stuff in it, so they can aggregate the data. You see, they can take the student data and they can put it with the business data. Now, people wonder, how can you do that? That violates FERPA. Well, first of all, we're moving towards blurring all that together where it basically doesn't mean very much. But in the meantime, what they absolutely can do is put something called UII data in there. So there's three categories for student data: UII, PII, and SIS. SIS is systems information, so this has to do with, like, data about the actual campus or the infrastructure, the whole institution, how it works as an institution. PII is personally identifiable information, so that's stuff that shows who the data actually belongs to, you know, age, race, gender, sex, all that type of stuff. Okay, and then the UII is user interaction information. This would be as long as that would essentially be anonymized, so your cognitive behavioral algorithms, they can use that just to do metadata analyses of how particular populations react. Okay, and so this would be totally, you know, fair in terms of FERPA because there's nobody's individual data being leaked. They're just taking your data, your metadata, which is by the way, in thinking out loud as I'm talking about this, I that's really the main goal of all of it is harvesting that data and then recrunching it. So they want to know, for purposes of developing artificial general intelligence, they want to know how the human mind evolves, how it learns. And so they want to see it through all those developmental stages that, you know, Erickson and Vygotsky, and you know, put those data sets in those developmental categories to see, right, what they can come up with for their AI. So I can't imagine that, you know, they'll leave the little ones out of the mix.
This maybe takes us a little bit backwards, but you had mentioned the notion of, like, well, the asynchronous learning where you're doing all your stuff in Google Classroom and it's quote more paced that at the student level, that's going to be the route towards moving the teacher out of the process. But what about us teachers who are saying, well, I'm going to do synchronous learning. I'm going to have my students be here on Zoom. Maybe I'm not even going to use Google Classroom too much, or I'll try to stay out of that. So maybe what would you say to that teacher who says, well, I'm going to keep my kids out of that system by doing that? Is that a bullet? Is that a protective shield? What would you say about that? Because that's actually probably, for reasons of just it being more like a teaching experience, I'm probably going to be teaching that way, which is the synchronous learning. Is that a workaround to what is the larger project here? Maybe can you say something about that?
Yeah, this is what I pitched as an adult. So you know, we're teachers, and at the end of the day, I mean, you know, there's things we can push back and things, but, you know, we all know administration basically is going to make the final decision. So to the effect that we are forced to do full distance learning or even blended learning, which would be you're there half this week and half the week you're on the same thing. I don't think anybody's going back fully. I think at the very best you'll be blended. So everybody's going to be doing something. I would say that is the best route. I call it, we talked to you about martial arts the other day, doing jiu-jitsu. It's like, I would say it's like pulling guard. You know, and I know some guys like guard, but, you know, you usually want to be on top, right?
Yeah.
And so, there's things you can do from guard. You're not out of the game yet, but ideally, if you can be on your feet or on top, this is a better scenario. And so, I like this. Yes, I am. And to do it without any of the extra automated feedback software or anything that's data mining,
even some of the, I'm not big on the learning management system, you know, the LMSs, the, you know, the Blackboard, D2L, all that stuff. Like, yeah, I get it. It's a little platform for people to put stuff. I usually see when I tutor, students are usually more confused about it than not. But even that type of stuff, like, I think that if we have to be online, that's what I say. Right, why can't it just be, so instead of we're in the room, this is the room. Now, if you guys, you've seen your science teacher, you know, labs, you know, I mean, I'm teaching rhetoric, you know, English writing, so I can pretty much do everything through the screen, you know, and I tried to make that argument, and this is what I got. I got a middle ground compromise, which was, okay, you can do that if you want, but you have to record the session in case nobody shows up or in case students don't want to show up. And so I don't want to be bumping my head too much. I'm like, okay, you know, at least I have the option to do that. I have the option to say, but my guess is what's going to happen is, it's just like they do with the asynchronous, they'll, well, I'll watch it later. You know, and I'll be there by myself. I'm sure there'll be a couple of students that, you know, want to keep up with stuff daily. But so, yeah, I think that would be the best because it, you know, it keeps looking like if the goal here, if we need to be super concerned about spreading COVID, it keeps people from doing that without adding all of this data mining. And it doesn't. And by the way, the reason I also like synchronous learning is because, as I mentioned earlier, it gives them it makes them prioritize a daily routine, right? And so if you're getting checked for attendance and you're not there, right, it helps. Okay, I have to do this today. I have to do this, and you know, that is part of teaching sometimes. Is, you know, getting, you know, I know I just railed against, you know, the whole routinized stimulus response method, but you know, before even that, there is a hallmark of education. Some of it is repetition, right? I mean, you do have to know something. You got to do a little rehearsal, so and have some kind of, you know, structure to put the information. So yes, that is if you can't get back in, I would say yes, synchronous, virtual, no adaptive learning, no data mining. Right? I mean, I say no, but you have. We know that every computer you use is doing something. So, I mean, minimal to the effect that, you know, it needs to run on the system. But it shouldn't be looking at any you know, PII and stuff like that, or you know, shouldn't be sharing it as well.
I guess the one question I'd have then is, I'm sorry, guys, but because I think my school district is actually going to be encouraging us to do an engagement, a student engagement synchronous learning sort of first period, second period, third period, like students being on a bell schedule with a computer, you know, and then they log into my class and then they log into another teacher's class. Are you kind of saying, well, then that it sort of somewhat suggests that they're not doing that good of a job then of shepherding us into the data, if that was the goal. In some ways, I would have a question about that if synchronous is that much of a barrier to this process.
Yeah, you'd have to, and then, well, let me say two things. One is, you know, I think that, like I said, you know, it's one of the most immediate things I think you can do to at least slow things down. The fact that people are open to that and doing minimal data tracking and stuff also shows, just as, which is my experience, you know, talking to people at the colleges and stuff, I mean, like, as you mentioned, you know, people are largely just disoriented. And so I think they don't have enough experience with any of this to say, yeah, that's better or worse. So, you know, if you can make the case, you know what I mean? And if people, you know, to listen to it, you know, I think that does say that, you know, right, we're not just being, you know, corralled, you know, like cattle, you know, there is potentially some wrenches in the gears, to use Allison's term, that they could be going in there right now. You know, but does it really slow it down that much? That might also depend more on like what you're using. So if you're using Zoom, I guess, you know, I mean, you'd have to look at the specific data policies of what you're using. So, because one of the other things I ran into with the Google Classroom was, or Google Meet, whichever platforms, Google something. And they wanted us, I said, I don't feel comfortable with that because Google got in trouble, sued, and admitted that they did it.
data mining students' emails and selling it to third parties for non-educational purposes, and then there was other suits as well, and then, you know, and they're the ones involved in the BigQuery through the Innovate EDU, and, you know, I should also mention that they're starting to invest in Hashgraph technology, which is a type of blockchain technology which hooks up to stuff like the social credit networks that they have in China. We don't want to go too far into that, but so what I said was I was uncomfortable with the recorded videos, because I mean it's one thing to just stream it through, and it might still be recording. You know, Google is just anything that touches it, it just takes it and just stores it forever. But I mean, certainly if you record it, I gotta assume Google's got that somewhere. You know, and then we're having discussions. Some student wants to experiment with an idea that they might be embarrassed or whatever. You know, that they wish they didn't say later, and now Google has it forever. You know, I mean, so that depends on what you use. So one of the things that like maybe we'll talk about later at the end when we talk about what can people do, parents, teachers, administrators, staff, paraprofessionals. Ask them to give you the privacy and data sharing policies on everything that you're using. And don't settle for some kind of, you know, summary of the policy. No, you want the policy. You want that, you know, like when you buy a technology and before you can sign off on it, it says read the privacy policy. And if you read it, you'd be at the store all day. That's what you want. You know, that's a legal document. That's what it does. And then, you know, ask for a digital one, do a keyword search, so the stuff I talked about, and then you'll probably find stuff and you don't like, and then just be polite and say, hey, can we not do this? Or can, you know, how can we, you know, not, should we not contract with this? Or is there a way? See, I also, for example, you know, I brought this up and they said, well, there's a video you can use through D2L. Okay, now I gotta look into D2L now, but I'm up front, I'm a little more comfortable with D2L than I am. I mean, I know Google, you know, what they'll try to do with it, but, you know, I don't know. I'm pretty sure the LMSs are supposed to be internally secure because you have grades on there, you know, and they originally were not designed to be sharing data with BigQuery like they will be later. So, I think it's a useful. You know, you're in a rock and a hard place. You got to find something to do. You know, something. You can't sit still, right? And so and as you do these things, you know, you'll learn as you go, right? So you'll also still have to respond, and then that slows the process down. It's a learning curve. You're learning more. Other people might come on board, and this is how this works, I think.
You know, John, we have talked about here on what's left about the settler capitalists. Exploiting a crisis and using the moment of any crisis to accelerate what has already been planned or what was slowed down. And now this might be a little sensitive issue to discuss because, you know, it's COVID-19 right now. This is the pandemic we're in, and this I was wondering if you could speak to the justification for these necessary new ways of learning in education. And I was listening to an economist called Emily Auster, I think it was, on NPR, and she was saying that it's very challenging to hold these conversations because no one wants to come out and say something controversial or say something about reopening schools where, you know, the death of someone or something that might be attributed to the reopening of schools might feel like teachers are being blamed for because of their desire to want to reopen schools. So, we're having challenging times, but we're not really having any conversations about reopening schools because it is challenging to discuss this in the midst of this pandemic. So maybe you could then help us thread through that. What do you see are the justifications or maybe your rebuttals or your or your thoughts about this as we try to engage in conversations about reopening schools.
So the justification bears on the threat of the virus and the extent of the threat, right? And so how deadly or how dangerous is it? To those who want to know why this might be necessary, okay? To the extent that it's necessary has to do to the extent of the danger, okay? And I'm going to argue that the danger is such that we should be going back to school. But let's look at both scenarios, right? And let's narrow this down based on the actual data, okay? So we could be as precautious as possible, right? Assuming the greatest dangers, or we can go back to the old normal, not the new normal, which is going back to face-to-face classes. Okay, so if we want to be most precautious, which I say is overly precautious, I would say that even in the most dangerous scenario based on the data, it is not unreasonable for only the vulnerable populations, immunocompromised, comorbidities, or if you live with somebody that has those issues, that only those students should need to or should be, if they want, be facilitated the distance learning, okay? Because I think that that is the most effective way to continue teaching, but also I think it's the most effective public health strategy, and there's several reasons why. So obviously, as you and I have discussed, it's more effective in terms of teaching because whatever they think is going to be better about this stuff, certainly the kinks aren't worked out, and we've gone through this synchronous, asynchronous stuff. But in general, though, if we just did protected the vulnerable, this would be less disruptive to our way of life and the economy generally, less invasive to civil liberties in terms of all the contact tracing, data tracking, and just not being able to assemble, would save public funds that we could use for other necessities. And I would say that this helps develop the herd immunity more effectively and more efficiently because the data demonstrates it's incredibly rare to do anything to children other than make them immune to it, right? And pass through it. So I would think that in the long run, right? I mean, that would be better for the public health as well. Okay. But let's just look at the data and see if we even need to be that precautious. So if we look at the CDC data, and we're going to post some of these, they have since April, they've been calculating confirmed and probable deaths from COVID. What a probable death means is that there was no laboratory proven test, a culture taken. So basically what it means is there was either diagnosis, telehealth, or there was some other presumptions is the language they use, whether in a lab or based on epidemiological data, you know, so you had some kind of a symptom that could be COVID and you died, and so they added it to that. Now, you can see a little more detailed chart of how that data is obscured when you look at a chart that we'll put up that discusses everything about deaths involving COVID. And there's several categories which also add deaths involving COVID plus pneumonia, deaths involving COVID plus influenza, deaths involving COVID plus comorbidities, and then there's just deaths involving COVID. But none of them are deaths of only confirmed cases. So that total number is about 150,000-ish right now, is clearly either inflated or inaccurate. Now, why would they do that? Right? Well, if you didn't know, the CDC, as much as it likes to pretend like it's a public organization, takes lots and lots of money from private organizations, one of them being the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and also Big Pharma. But the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as we've discussed, right, has they have other interests in keeping us locked down so that they can facilitate all the stuff they've been investing in as far as distance learning and now their reimagined education project. So there might be some conflict of interest in how they report this data, but you can look at that yourself. At the same time, you know, the people that want to sit, the authoritative expert doctors, there's hundreds of thousands of deaths from medical errors every year, okay? And in the meantime, while they say it's too dangerous to go back to school and be shoulder to shoulder in classrooms, the governors who have been most enthusiastic about locking down have also been some of the governors that have said, go ahead and protest. Go ahead and get shoulder to shoulder out in the streets and protest, but you can't go to school and learn. So there's also some contradictions in how they apply the policy, aside from the obscure data that they provide. Okay, so there's the range. And I would say that, right, based on that data, we should go back to school, okay? But let's say this. Let's say you're not convinced. Either way, whichever side you want to take, the most precautious, the least precautious, you need to know that disaster capitalists are going to hijack this process in order to create permanent change. So that's permanent lockdown, permanent control of the economy, permanent distance learning, permanent data mining. And so they can basically take over the economy. I mean, look at big tech right now. Record profits, right? Facebook, Amazon, and now all these, K-12 Inc., all these companies are gonna join the group. And, you know, if you don't think that that's what happens with disaster capitalism, with creative destruction, where they take their disruptive technologies and upend an entire industry, replace an entire labor force with automation, if you don't think that that's how that works, just look at disaster capitalism in Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina. So they wanted to build back better, the school system. So they said, let's get rid of these public schools, these government schools. They built back better corporate charter schools. But they didn't just build back better in that little area that was smashed up by a hurricane. They said, let's go for the whole state. Let's go ahead and go even further with it. So this is what happens with big government and big corporations during a crisis, okay? And it's not just in the education sector. If you look at a document, a Rockefeller Foundation document, I want to say 2010 to 2011, it's scenarios for the future of technology and international development, and they play out a simulation in there, something called Operation Lockstep, which basically talks about a pandemic scenario where they say, quote, authoritarian regimes would use the crisis not just to mitigate the dangers, but to lockdown and to take permanent control. Okay, so you should know that even if we do need to take as much precaution as possible, whatever precautions we take, know that whatever ground you give up, you will not get back, just like during the Patriot Act. Whichever rights you give up will be very, very difficult to get back. So at the very least, okay, regardless of where you fall on this spectrum, we should at least, because if you're still scared, you should at least hold back by just doing synchronous virtual classrooms with no data mining. Because if the goal, if this is really just to keep us safe during the pandemic, and when it's over, we're going to go back to real normal, not the new normal. If this is the goal, then we shouldn't be going way beyond what we already normally do. We should be trying to stay as close to that as possible, because we're going to go back to that. And if they're not, then that should be evidence that what I'm telling you is true. Okay. And so my final word is this, because it's an emotional topic, it's a scary topic. Whatever you feel right now, whatever you think you know about the virus, do me a favor and check out the primary source documentation, in particular the CDC. Okay. And you tell me if my analysis of the data is inaccurate. If you can show me some primary source evidence, I changed my mind here, okay? But I don't think that that's going to happen. And so that's what I would say about for people that think it's necessary.
I have the same question you had, Eduardo, about, you know, basically drawing the parallels, you know, because you mentioned 9/11 and this massive repression of society that happened. You know, we can no longer walk someone to the airplane. You know, we got to go through all these security checkpoints, and fear is basically the easiest way to sell something, right? But yeah, but I mean, I am curious. You did mention push harder, in your argument a second ago. What does that look like to you? What is pushing harder?
Man, say no, man. Just say no. Like, I'm not gonna. I don't want. And the other thing is, like, here's one. I mean, like, you know, they want to do the temperature checks. And okay, fine, I guess, you know, but I asked them, "What are you doing with that? It's in a machine. It's not a freaking, you know, Mercury. Anything that's got a computer in it is tracking some kind of data. So my question is, what kind of data is it tracking? Is it sharing it with? I would like to see what the actual privacy statement is." He sent me a freaking a statement from a law firm about these. It was like a general statement. It was an international law firm about temperature checks at businesses. Like, that's not a court order. It's not a state law. It's not a federal law. It's not the privacy policy of technology. It's not the privacy policy. So now I have to politely say, no, that's not what I asked for. And actually, the funny thing is, if you read the thing that you sent me, it says in there you're supposed to inform me specifically as to what to do with the data. Like, so this is what I mean. Like, when you go up to say, to ask for the data, to question the data, they're gonna try to some people, and I don't mean necessarily even intentionally, like, you know, there's this conspiracy, but I mean that they want that grant, or they want that CARES money, or they don't want backlash from the public, or they don't want, you know what I mean, there's reasons why they want to keep their job, whatever it is, there's reasons why. They just want, just go along and get along, dude. Don't be difficult is kind of what they want. And you know that you're not being difficult. You're not being a jerk. You're asking the right to know what they want you to do before you do it. And, you know, don't be satisfied with platitudes and vague. It's been like three times that I've had to, you know what I mean? Every time I get a little closer, but no, that's not it. Still not it. And, dude, it's stressful, man, because, like, you know, I told you, I'm an adjunct. I am a union, adjunct union, but we're still technically at will. Like, and then they got rid of the Janus law, so technically they don't even really have to, you know, I mean, they signed contracts, so as long as but, you know, they don't have to re-up it and things like that. But, you know, and I'm up here, and I've got to, you know, every time they do that, what I mean by, you know, push back more is don't be like, oh, well, I tried, and, you know, I can see that they don't want to tell me, so I don't want to keep, you know, being that guy. I mean, you know, look, if the way I see it is, you know, I always start every conversation off with, look, I'm very glad that everybody's worried about the safety of our students. I'm very happy, you know, I know everybody here, me as well, but let's be careful about this data, too. So that's what I mean. I mean, just be specific. Know exactly what you need to, what you want to know, and then there'll come a point probably when you get that information, and you're not going to like it, and then that's probably the part where you push back the most, and maybe say, hopefully you can get more people to agree with you at the college, and then you can negotiate. But I don't know that I'm comfortable with some of the data. I've got friends that drag trees, and I'm a physical guy. Maybe I will drag trees. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I mean. But in the meantime, I love teaching. I like people I work with. I want to work with them. I want to negotiate democratically at a public institution. You know, what we do with student-teacher data, and you get to have a say in it. You know, this thing called informed consent. Imagine that. Like, so that's what I mean, I guess. You know, and that comes in different shades. You know, it could just be one person like me. You know, and one person, just your one person at your school, or maybe it's you got a group like y'all do, you know, and you got three or four or more people, and, you know, maybe you can build on that. So I guess that's what I mean.
John, you shared with us that the censored capitalists are taking advantage of this time, but can you just maybe call out a few that you shared with us are pushing for this drive in education?
Okay, so, you know, so two ways I guess we could look at it. I would say more the biggest players are the corporate foundations, right? Those nonprofit foundations. And then the actual corporations involved that facilitate it would be the companies, the ed tech companies, and some of the software companies. So, the foundations, the big one is Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There's also a long history of Carnegie Foundation, there's so many different Carnegie Institute. You know, there's one for education. And I always use the wrong title, but it's that one. Okay. And they actually blur into the other ones because Institute for Science kind of will fund the same agenda sometimes. And then Rockefeller Foundation. And, you know, if you I think you asked me where I got started earlier, and I started with Project Best. You could go back to, though, I already mentioned Wilhelm Wundt. The first, one of the founding fathers, so to speak, of psychology in America would have been G. Stanley Hall. It would also be William James, but G. Stanley Hall is basically a close second. G. Stanley Hall was a PhD of Wilhelm Wundt. And G. Stanley Hall was like six. It's in my book. I have a chart in there. It's hundreds of PhDs in education. He basically set up Wilhelm Wundt's ideas of stimulus response. He's the one that turned psychology from a study of philosophy into laboratory science. And all these PhDs, so people like James McKean Cattell and Professor Judd and there's one guy who escapes me, but he really was into Galton. I can't remember him right now. But then there's also E.L. Thorndike, okay? John Dewey, he was a student of G. Stanley Hall, and out of him you get John B. Watson, that's behaviorism. And again, the torch is passed to B.F. Skinner, and that gets us up to Project Best. Well, that whole time, starting with the Hall's PhDs, you had the General Education Board, which was the first Rockefeller philanthropy, and it was for funding schools, and it was basically for funding all the stuff we're talking about, the stimulus response stuff, and basically workforce training, or for vocational ed. So those would be like some of the foundations, and basically, they basically handed it. I mean, the Gates Foundation is much larger than those nonprofits are now, but they're still around, and they still spend a lot of money on this stuff, right, here and globally. The companies involved, K-12 Inc. is a big one, okay, it's a virtual online school. Connections Academy, I see commercials for that on the TV all the time as well. That is a Pearson-owned company. And Pearson is another one of those companies that you want to keep an eye out for. I think that's the world.
Yeah.
Mention that somebody on the board or one of the committees that wrote those federal regulations, that 85 FR 18638, the new ones, was a representative of IBM. Okay. And so those would be some of the online schools, virtual schools. And for the software companies, I would say you have stuff like, I might be naming the products and not the actual company, but you'll find them either way. So Dreambox, Smart Sparrow, Clever, Newton, that's K-N-E-W-T-O-N. Trying to think. So those would be some, the adaptive learning softwares. The social-emotional learning stuff, those biofeedback wearables and things. And another reason why I think you're going to see those in education soon, real quick, by the way, is because I've seen a lot of commercials for it in the larger consumer realm for healthcare and fitness. So that's what your Fitbits are, okay? And I've seen this thing. It's like for if you got heart problems, it reads your EKGs, okay? But the companies, the education one is called BrainCo. Okay, that's funded. It's a partnership company between some people out of Harvard and China, a Chinese funded company. Then there is Effectiva, Achille, okay, which does like digital video game prescriptions for ADHD. Okay, so that's one other thing I didn't mention is that they'll use some of these when they get into the social emotional learning. The way it'll be pitched is for. It'll basically replace your counselors and your paraprofessionals that help with students that have disabilities and stuff. So, right, if you're at home now and you can't bring somebody there to help them, you know, like for their IEP, they'll have like a the headband or the bracelet will give them feedback when they get distracted. So, I should also mention NeuroCore. There's an article I wrote. It's called Just Google. Oh, I can't remember the whole thing. Just Google DeVos and Neurocore, or Betsy DeVos and Neurocore. It'll be on. It should show up on the first page of Google. It was a pretty popular article. It's a dissident voice, but it's about how DeVos. Well, she still funds Neurocore, one of the biggest funders of it, but was sitting on the board of it until she became Secretary of Education. That company, one of the things that it does is it treats ADHD, and you wear the EEG monitor, and the student like will play a game or watch a video, and it's monitoring the waves, and it looks at, you know, is the student focused, is the student not focused. When that algorithm changes to not focused, the game stops, or it gives some feedback that makes the kid have to get back on track. And so that will be what they pitch it for, is to help those students. So those are some of the main companies that I would, different technology companies, several layers, I would say.
And I do want to talk more about solutions, or at least things that are coming up in my mind. Where do you see this all headed? Like, where is this leading, if it carries on in this way?
Yeah, so another term that we talked about, disaster capitalism, a couple times, and Naomi Klein kind of helped popularize that term there. And another term she uses, talks about a lot, is surveillance capitalism, and that's basically what we'd be talking about, right? Monetizing all that data, but monetizing it not in the traditional sense where they necessarily are going to sell it, but they're going to re-crunch it for the purposes of workforce planning and social engineering. So this might sound abstract at this point, and part of the reason I say it is because it still sounds like that for me, because I've just recently started looking at how the blockchain stuff works into it. Because I'd always touch on it. I'm just, like you said, as you know, to my articles, I'm looking at more like what's happening in the schools and then kind of looking out. But the reason why I'm starting looking at it now is because I noticed somebody sent me, when I did my research on that BigQuery partnership, is that BigQuery is partnering with this Hashgraph company. Hashgraph is a type of distributed ledger chain. That's like a blockchain. Okay. What that means is they can monetize or tokenize that data into something eventually that they call social credit. Okay. So if you never saw social, if you've never heard of social credit, or if you've never seen any examples of it, there is an ABC documentary. Maybe we'll post a link. I don't know if you can copyright stuff. I don't know if you want to actually play the video, put a link or something.
Yeah.
We'll put that. When I saw it, it put into first, like my wife had sent me the video of it. And when you see what it does in real time, I realized that's what it looks like when all the data gets aggregated. It's a big tech for the purposes of this workforce planning and this social engineering. It basically digitally monetizes all your behavior into a social score that's going to dictate your access to the public square, to everything from transportation, housing, healthcare, education, due process. They have political blacklists that can process and stuff. And one of the most targeted populations is the Uyghur people in the western provinces, I think it's Xinjiang. And, you know, they're an ethnic Islamic minority people, and they basically are treated like they live in an outdoor prison. And, you know, the way they monitor that is not just through, you know, what you post online. Like, they basically, I mean, they don't kick us out of the square yet, but just like they monitor everything, all what you post online, they also look at what you're doing in school and how good you're keeping your grades up. And there's another one. You go to Google BrainCore of videos of BrainCo and look at the kids in China, and they're sitting there, like, and, you know, they're getting demerits or, you know, points up, points down the whole time based on, not necessarily did they answer the questions, right? Like, are you paying enough attention to what the teacher's saying? But it also uses stuff like facial recognition in the public square. You know, so if you jaywalk or something, it whacks your social credit score in real time. There's no, the constable was wrong. I didn't actually step out into the street. I'm going to challenge this before the magistrate. And, you know, there's none of that. it's gone. There's no due process. And, you know, why do I say that that's where it's going? Well, one of the better indicators is what I just mentioned, because that Hashgraph company basically is setting up a blockchain network that partners with some of the biggest companies, Boeing, a bunch of big banks that I can't remember the names of, Google, Amazon, I think Microsoft might be on it as well, okay? And then there's also a related connection and partnership with China's BSN, their blockchain network, which they're going to integrate into their social credit system. Their social credit system is largely, I don't say experimental, but it's not the whole country right now. They're pretty much piloting a few cities, and then they're branching out. And when they really get it locked in, they want the blockchain, because what that blockchain does is it has a specific ledger of every transaction, every so it keeps an exhaustive, centralized list of all your data for like your psychological profile for your score. With the Chainlink connector in the BigQuery is doing, and some of the other databases that's linked to the blockchains, it's helping to pull data from off the blockchain into it. Okay, to monetize it for the purposes of eventually social credit. But another reason why I can say that's where we're going is not just because I can already see the companies set up. Basically, all they need is the green light to share the data and then legally monetize it. But the other reason why is, if you ask me, in my humble opinion, contact tracing is being social credit. Why do I say that? Because if social credit basically monetizes everything you do and restricts your access to the public square based on an aggregation of your health data, your educational data, your criminal justice data, and then a bunch of your other social behaviors. Right now, right, in America, we used to have, due process, privacy, jurisdiction, right? HIPAA protects medical, FERPA protects education. Right, and then you have your state laws and statutes, for criminal justice and things. Well, what happens then? And this is why I was doing the temperature. If they go to the school that's under FERPA, and they're collecting my temperature for the sake of a biomedical health review, Not just because you're checking my temperature to see if I'm sick, but because it says in there that if they think I'm sick or I think I might have been around someone, then I have to go get a medical review. Well, that tells me that you're sharing that the school, which is regulated by FERPA, is going to take my health records and then send them off to a doctor, or one way or another, right? That data is going to be shared with a doctor. At the very least, I can't come back until I share that data with the doctor. Okay? And here's the next part. Does it go to a contact tracing database? It probably does. And if it doesn't now, it probably will. So by the way, when you ask them for the privacy policy about the data, don't just ask them, what are they doing with it? What is it capable of doing as well? Because they might say, we're just going to do this with it right now. But later, if laws change, we might do something else with it. But with the contact tracing apps that they set up in Minnesota, the specific citation is in, I got it on my Twitter, it's Dallas Professor, at Professor Dallas. If you go in there, they were using those contact tracing apps to track the protesters. So now you took the healthcare data and you shared it with the criminal justice system, with the police system, for the purpose of police actions and police enforcement. So now you just merge all three of those databases together that are supposed to be separate, and it's all facilitated through one single technology. So my thing is, if am I going to end up like the man in Kentucky who, if I had a temperature and they think I got COVID, or they test me, because I got the temperature and then they make me get a test, are they going to put an ankle bracelet on me? I'm going to be on real house arrest, not virtual house arrest, which is the lockdown. But like, am I going to be like criminally for getting sick, not for committing a crime? Okay, so that's another thing that security and freedom. You can't have any for the sake, if you want to have any kind of autonomy, if you want to have any kind of say about your own life, you can't have somebody keeping you in perfectly safe all the time. That's called a maximum security prison. I mean, you know, you have to, inherently, and by the way, that's what I'm saying, right? So that's as safe as it'll get. And it's not that safe either, right? Because that's how, you know, institutions work. There's always a way to corrupt it. So, you know, there's a certain amount of risk that always is going to be there. So don't think that there's a way that we're going to all be safe from COVID if we just give up all of our privacy rights and all of our due process rights. Right? That's to go back to that dialectic of, you know, should, you know, is COVID versus living life like a human being, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, we've also, I mean, I can already tell you at my school, a group that's being factored out of this distance learning, not just by the district, but unfortunately even by our schools, like our EL population has been reduced dramatically. Our school admission specifically educates students who are English language learners, and not all of them have documentation, and these are folks we're trying to educate. Those folks are leaving the system quickly, you know, like they're not coming back. And so the dangers to people are immense, and the dangers to our education system and to the possible, and even to the notion of it being done equitably, which I don't think can be done under capitalism, but now it's being eradicated even more. So I wanted to say that. The other thing that I do feel like, I don't think you necessarily mentioned, but I think it's something that I've read you've talked about, and I think Alice mentioned, is ultimately that this process is going to really almost virtually eradicate public buildings where people meet to be educated eventually. And eventually it turns our job into data managers at best, and that the job of teaching is automated into an artificial intelligence, which on the basis of that aggregate data. So I do think those are the outcomes that I was sort of thinking about even just a year ago, kind of seemed on the horizon. Now it feels like almost a much more immediate reality as we move into this. So maybe if you want to say something about that, because I wanted to say something more about like what I think we could do or the possible ways we can resist this.
You know, you mentioned basically this process of becoming data managers and really also becoming data ourselves and becoming harvested for the purpose of harvesting others, right, for this machine, and how that basically is essentially just an engine to build more and more artificial intelligence, which is just for more automated workforce training, so social engineering. That's one of the other things that piqued my my radar on was I was working with some of these software, and I noticed that one of the projects had an IBM Watson that was going to tag along and get some data. And it occurred to me that, so I'm doing my job. This thing's going to be learning to copy me and start to do my job. Like, okay. And they're like, well, so every day, like digging my own grave, you know. And then I started thinking, you know, you just kind of like look down the pipe, right? You got a strap. Like, well, what happens when, I don't know how fast it'll happen, but what happens when this thing can teach better than me? Well, at that point, you've not only automated physical labor like robots building stuff, you've automated intellectual labor, which means you, in a sense, you know, as Elon Musk would like to say, you've made human thinking obsolete. And so this is why you have somebody like Elon Musk now saying that he's got a neural link for you. If you don't know what that is, it's a real-life brain-computer interface. Facebook's working on them as well. It comes out of DARPA projects, and Regina Dugan came out of DARPA, worked for Facebook, okay? And he thinks that that's the only way you'll be able to compete with artificial intelligence in this automated technocratic workforce system. Now, if that seems crazy, you know, just to put That stuff started in the 60s with Jose Manuel Rodriguez Delgado at Yale University. And they sent you a picture of it, and maybe we'll put some of those screenshots up there. But the first neural implants were in the 60s. John von Neumann was talking about, you know, and Alan Turing, those guys were talking about essentially artificial intelligence in the 50s. Well, it's 70 years, you know, for one, and then 60 for this is old stuff. And, you know, this is, like I mentioned earlier, they pretty much just want us to just shut up and get out of the way and plug it in. Because it's just like sitting on a shelf and they're just itching and rubbing their hands wanting to hook it all up. But so that's the second layer beyond the social credit. But that's a whole other rocket trip to the moon that we don't need to go through.
So, John... Actually, this is going to come back to that thing you said about synchronous learning being maybe a little bit better than asynchronous learning in terms of the data collection. And that has got me thinking during this episode, because the watchword of this time has been safety. Everyone's talking about safety. But I think the watchword that people need to be thinking about is control, because safety is being used as an exercise in control. And control, the groundwork for future control is being laid with the data collection, things like this. But I actually do think, this has left me to this, because there's another piece I feel like we've left out of this conversation of control, which is keeping people separated. And I actually think that that is a piece. So I think we are going to be asked to do synchronous learning, which is going to interfere with the process of data collection, because I do think that's the long-term project. But I think the immediate barriers towards doing any of this is a collective response to it, because I don't think there is I've talked with Eduardo. I don't think there is an individual way we can stop this thing coming. And I do feel like one main thing we maybe left out of this conversation I want to bring back to is the fact that whether we're teaching synchronous or asynchronously, we're going to be kept separate through the course of August and September. During a time, actually, where I actually think there's going to be austerity budgets for most teachers, and obviously austerities are going to be across the board in various ways, except for Amazon, which is doing fine in terms of profits, but their workers aren't going to see jack shit. I actually think, even though my union is sclerotic, has no intention of striking, I think there's still worry. There's still a fear that if we get together at some point in time, maybe we'll be like, wait, is this something we really want to be doing? So I think that keeping people physically separated, and workers in particular physically separated during this time, is also another aspect of this. Because I don't actually think they're fully ready to go fully online with the whole data collection. I think they're building up to it. And you're very right. When they've already told us next semester, we're not going back to full schools. We're going back to hybrid schools. So they already know that that's their staging ground for the longer term project of what did you call it, the check that people do, like the social credit scoring and things like that, you know. So it's made me think that they're doing two things, at least two things at once: a future of larger control and manipulation through massive data collection of all of us, but also the implementation of that project by keeping us separated. To not allow any sort of collective response whatsoever, which to me is the only way we could stop it in any meaningful way, because everything else is just like you're just a stone in the water. You get worn down, and then eventually the stone gets turned into sand, and it goes downstream. So I just wanted to say that.
No, that's absolutely, you know. And one of the funny things that happened was, I think I mentioned this to you. We talked, you know. I managed to wiggle my way into the committee that's talking about how they want to spend their carers' money at the school, because somebody had emailed, was upset that they wanted more teachers on them. And they were not very polite in the email. And I was polite, but I sent them a lot of information, essentially. You know, it was quotes from the 85FR 18638. The we use D2L, so showing them how that would fit into that, a bright space leave awesome. And you know, the initial response before they invited me to come on and, you know, share my research and stuff was no more mass emails. You know, I mean, what do you think? The first time I was like, wait, I mean, now it was They were nagging on it and let us guess, you know, because I guess people thought that would look kind of, I don't know, you know, reactionary, I guess. But, you know, I could have been more cool, but I mean, yeah, we should have some teachers on there, you know. And so, no, definitely, now I can't talk, you know, there's only a few of us that actually go to union meetings when we do the virtual meetings. By that, I mean, maybe a handful, okay, and is there at least over 100? There's some at community colleges.
Yeah.
It's at least 100 something adjuncts. I could be wrong. Could be more. But I don't see him in the network. And I got a friend. She was training with a very good friend of mine, and I can't talk to him. Like, I mean, I don't know what's going on, but I'm imagining he doesn't want to. He's freaked out about COVID, right? And And I don't want to text him and send him, because I would never talk to him about a lot of this stuff. I try to get along with people as best as possible. You know, I'll bring up topics that people, you know, are not receptive. They looked at me like, you know, they're glazed over. I find a way to make friends with them and be normal and get along. And by the way, I could have shared this with this guy. I was like, I'm just going to give him a book. And then things got busy, and then COVID happened, and they never shared it with him. So I can't text him, you know what I mean? He'd probably look at me. He'd probably think, even though he knows me, if I bombarded him with. So, yeah, I mean, like, and he's a close friend of mine. So, yes, it is, I hate to be, exaggerated. But it's almost like being under siege, you know what I mean? Like, you know, that's one of the first things you do when you're under siege is you mess up communication so that people can't organize and get together. So, just tossing that idea out there.
Any other words of advice you might give for teachers or educators who are about to come into the August distance learning stuff?
Basically, ask some very specific questions about not just new technologies that you might be using or getting from your CARES money at your school, but also what you're going to be doing with the technology you already have. Because maybe that technology can be converted or connected and start doing new things. Or maybe it was already doing some things you didn't know about that you might not like. And so ask what is the general privacy policy of whatever technology. Now, most schools are going to use layers. So you might have a learning management system. You might have an adaptive learning software that connects to it. And then they might be plugging in some of these contact tracing technologies. And, you know, even if you think that that's a good idea, I think we all agree that somehow, if you could, I don't think there's a way you can do it like this, except that you'd have to burn that data or get rid of it somehow. No, that's not how it works. Once it's created and sent, it's basically alive, you know. So you should also, yes, I mean, at least know what that contact tracing, the temperature tape, any new stuff they're putting in. You want to know what is its general privacy policy, and what is its policy for sharing data with third parties. It's always good to be more specific when you ask questions that you know people are not going to want to give you the answers for. If you ask a vague question, they might give you a vague answer and be like, "Oh, that's your question," right? So you want to ask them, when you mention third parties, you want to mention something like, do we share with other state or federal departments of education, workforce and labor, health and human services, or criminal justice? Okay, and then also, does it share data with any ed tech companies, learning analytics databases, nonprofit educational organizations, or other for-profit or nonprofit companies? Ask the same thing for each technology, and then also ask what your school's policy is about how it uses that data, because there's layers to it, right? The technology, once it gets its data, that company, it has its own thing it's going to be doing. Now, obviously, it's got to be contracted with the school. But then the school is on the other end, and they might be doing not two mutually exclusive things or contradictory, but they might be sharing them in one place, and your school might be sharing them in another. So ask both of those layers, and do it for all the specific technologies. That's what I would say. And then when they give you that document, don't go through all the keywords. I think we'll post them or something that way. But there'll be a list of keywords that you can pull in here. And because when you get those documents, remember, make sure that they give you the actual document, not a summary of the policy. And then you're not going to read those whole things. That's not how you do it. That's not how the research works. You're going to keyword search some of those words, and then you're going to find those spots, read what that says, and, you know, make sure it's not going anywhere that you don't want it to. And if it does, ask them, you know, is there a way to either get a different company, not use that company at all? Is there a different contract where that clause doesn't apply? You know, when I did my book, you know, my publisher is a gentleman and a great guy. You know, I was able to, it's a small little clause, but, you know, I was able to say, can we change this here? And he says, yeah, you change that here. So it's not impossible either. Okay? I mean, you know, sometimes a company might have to. But those are the things you want to do. And then share that. And then if you find something, right, before you go to the administrators or whatever and say, hey, share it with your colleagues first. Start with people that are receptive. Get a couple people to say, see what you're seeing. Then go, and then, as you mentioned, build that collective base and go from there.
Go ahead. What were you saying?
No, I was just saying, thanking John. I think this has been, again, really good information, and I appreciate your time to talk about this. And, you know, for people to get a chance to hear, it's a lot, and it can be very confusing for me to kind of like put together things, but I feel like the overall picture is fairly clear.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here. I was really super happy to share all this stuff. And yes, because, you know, I was looking into the blockchain stuff, and man, it took me one night just to even just a DLT. There's so many different layers to how one technology works, and it took me hours to figure out what it's a learning curve. You know, once you now I was like, okay, now you know what that is. Next time you read about it, now you can read faster. So, but I remember reading that and going, that's probably what people feel like when they hear me, because I've been reading about this, and it's just like, yeah, and it goes like, you know, all the way up to the blockchain. So it made me appreciate, yes, how other people might feel, and it's normal, it's natural, it's just you know, don't freak out too much, take your time, it'll once you go around the circuit a couple of times, you'll get faster too. So yeah.
All right. Well, I think this is a good place for us to wrap up, John. Thank you for being with us. So that does it for this week's episode. John Kleizig shared with us our discussion. Thank you again. John Kleizig is author of Squo World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. What's Left is a weekly political podcast / channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes. Wherever you found this episode or on our blog, at what-s-left.webnode.com, you can find past episodes of this podcast / channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you have heard here, please share with your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms on Spotify, iTunes Podcast, The Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you have heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Valca with co-hosts Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. Thank you again, John, and see you all next time.
Nice again, guys.